This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents So Anyway by John Cleese. Read for you by the author.
Chapter 1. I made my first public appearance on the stairs up to the school nurse's room at St. Peter's Preparatory School, Weston-super-Mare, Somerset, England, on the 13th of September 1948. I was 8 5/6. My audience was a pack of 9-year-olds who were jeering at me and baying, "Cheese! Cheese!" I kept climbing up the steps despite the feeling of humiliation and fear, but above all, I was bewildered. How had I managed to attract so much attention? What had I done to provoke this aggression? And how on earth did they know that my family surname had once been Cheese? As Matron Fishy Finlater gave me the customary new boy physical examination, I tried to gather my thoughts. My parents had always warned me to keep away from nasty, rough boys. What, then, were they doing at a nice school like St. Peter's? And how was I supposed to avoid them? Much of my predicament was that I was not just a little boy, but a very tall little boy. I was 5'3" and would pass the 6-foot mark before I was 12, so it was hard to fade into the background, as I often wished to, particularly later when I'd become taller than any of the masters. It didn't help that one of them, Mr. Bartlett, always referred to me as a prominent citizen. In addition, as a result of my excessive height, I had outgrown my strength, and my physical weakness meant that I was uncoordinated and awkward, so much so that a few years later my PE teacher, Captain Lancaster, described me as 6 foot of chewed string. Add to that the fact that I had no previous experience of the feral nature of gangs of young boys, and you will understand why my face bore the expression of an authentic coward as Fishy Finlater opened the door and coaxed me out towards my second public appearance. "Don't worry, it's only teasing," she said. What consolation was that? You could have said the same at Nuremberg. But at least the chanting had stopped, and now there was an expectant silence as I forced myself down the stairs. Then, "Are you a roundhead or a cavalier?" "What?" Faces were thrust at me, each one of them demanding, "Roundhead or cavalier?" What were they talking about? Had I understood the question, I would almost certainly have fainted. Such a delicate little flower was I. And perhaps I should explain to the more delicately nurtured of you that I was not being asked to offer my considered views on the relative merits of the opposing forces in the English Civil War, but to reveal whether or not I had been circumcised. However, my first day at prep school was not a total failure. By the time I got home, I had learned the meaning of 2 new words, pathetic and wet, although I had to find Dad's dictionary to look up sissy. Why was I so ineffectual? Well, let's begin at my beginning. I was born on the 27th of October 1939 in Uphill, a little village south of Weston-super-Mare and separated from it by the mere width of a road which led inland from the Western Sea Front. My first memory, though, is not of Uphill, but of a tree in the village of Brent Knoll, a few miles away, under whose shade I recall lying while I looked through its branches to the bright blue sky above. The sunlight is catching the leaves at different angles so that my eye flickers from one patch of colour to the next, the verdant foliage displaying a host of verdant hues. I thought I'd try and get the words verdant, hues, and foliage into this paragraph, as my English teachers always believed they were signs of creative talent, though perhaps I shouldn't have used verdant twice. Of course, I'm not sure it was my first memory. I'm sure I used to think it was. And I like to think it was, because it would make sense, baby me lying in a pram, contentedly watching the interplay of the glinting, verdant foliage and its beautiful hues. One thing I do know for certain, though, is that shortly before this incident with the tree, the Germans bombed Weston-super-Mare. I'll just repeat that. On the 14th of August 1940, German planes bombed Weston-super-Mare. This is verifiable. It was in all the papers, especially the Western Mercury. Most Westonians were confident that the raid had been a mistake. The Germans were a people famous for their efficiency, so why would they drop perfectly good bombs on a place like Weston-super-Mare when there was nothing in Weston that a bomb could destroy that could possibly be as valuable as the bomb that destroyed it? It would mean that every explosion made a tiny dent in the German economy. The Germans did return, however, and several times, which mystified everyone. Nevertheless, I can't help thinking that Westonians quite liked being bombed. It gave them a sense of significance that was otherwise lacking from their lives. But that still leaves the question, why would the Hun have bothered? Was it just Teutonic joie de vivre? Did the Luftwaffe pilots mistake the Western Sea Front for the Western Front? I've heard it quite seriously put forward by older Westonians that it was done at the behest of William Joyce, the infamous Lord Haw-Haw, who was hanged as a traitor in 1946 by the British for making Nazi propaganda radio broadcasts to Britain during the war. When I asked these amateur historians why a man of Irish descent who was born in Brooklyn would have such an animus against Western that he would buttonhole Hitler on the matter, they fell silent. I prefer to believe that it was because of a grudge held by Reich Marshal Hermann Göring on account of an unsavory incident on Western Pier in the 1920s, probably involving Noel Coward and Terence Rattigan. My father's explanation, however, made the most sense. He said the Germans bombed Western to show that they really do have a sense of humour. Whatever the truth of the matter, 2 days after that first raid, we had moved to a quaint little Somerset village called Brent Knoll. Dad had had quite enough of big bangs during his 4 years in the trenches in the First World War in France, and since he was up to nothing in Western that was vital to the war effort, he spent the day after the bombing driving around the countryside near Western until he found a small farmhouse owned by a Mr. and Mrs. Raffle, who agreed to take the Cleese family on as paying guests. I love the fact that he didn't mess around. We were out of there. And it was typically smart of him to find a farmer at a time of strict rationing. An egg or a chicken or even a small pig could go missing without attracting too much attention. Mother told me once that some Westonians privately criticised Dad for retreating so soon. They apparently felt it would have been more dignified to have waited a week or two before running away. But I think this view misses the essential point of running away, which is to do it the moment that the idea has occurred to you. Only an obsessional procrastinator would cry, "Let's run for our lives, but not till Wednesday afternoon." Back to the tree. I visited the farm many years later, and just as I thought I remembered, there was a huge chestnut tree in the middle of the front lawn under which I might easily have lain in a pram. In 1940, the farmhouse had been one of a row of houses of medium size, strung out along a road with fields opposite. Didn't look very farm-like from the front, but once you walked up the drive and got to the back of the house, you saw there was a proper farmyard with mud and chickens and rusty farm equipment and ferrets in cages and rabbits in wooden hutches. And it was this location that provided my second memory. It must come after the first, because in it I am now standing up. I was bitten by a rabbit. Or rather, I was nibbled by a rabbit. But because I was such a weedy, namby-pamby little pansy, I reacted as though I'd lost a leg. It was the sheer unfairness of it all that so upset me. One minute I was saying, "Hello, Mr. Bunny," smiling at its sweet little face and its funny, floppy ears, and the next the fucker savaged me. Seems so gratuitous. What, I asked myself, had I done to the rabbit to deserve this psychotic response? More pertinent question, though, is why was I such a wuss? And the obvious answer is because I was the only child of older, overprotective parents. I have a memory, number three, to support this. I'm now about three, and I'm in the Red Cow in the hub and beating heart of Brent Knoll. Somehow I bang my hand, and just before I burst into tears, I held it up to my father and howl, "Daddy, look, I've hurt my precious thumb." This, to my astonishment, gets a big laugh. Is my thumb not precious, I wonder? Daddy certainly thinks it is. When the occasion demands, he always says, Oh, you've hurt your precious fill-in applicable body part. I hesitate to criticize Dad because what sanity I have, I owe to his loving kindness. But there's no doubt that he did pamper me, and such early coddling was one of the reasons I embarked on a wussy lifestyle. Throughout my schoolboy days, I never felt very manly or strong or virile or vigorous or healthily aggressive. At school, I avoided playground gangs because I didn't understand why anyone would want to behave like that. I loved ball games, but was always appalled at how rough, for example, rugby looked, even at the safe distance I kept while pretending to play it. When I was 17, my assistant Clifton College housemaster, Alec MacDonald, finally took me to task for funking tackles. Describing my efforts as dancing around like a disabled fairy, he ordered me to watch while he gave a demonstration of how to tackle properly. He asked a member of the Clifton First 15, Tony Rogers, to run at him. He closed in on Rogers and then went in hard, just as Rogers tried to sidestep him. The result was the top of Mr. MacDonald's head came into sharp contact with Rogers' right hip. And Mr. MacDonald was unavailable for teaching later that afternoon. Indeed, he did not reappear for some 48 hours, and when he did, I was too cowardly to remind him that he'd specifically told me that if you go in hard, you never get hurt. So when I see international rugby teams lumbering out at Twickenham, I look at them with awe, but also with a sense of being genetically disconnected from any of them. I was not born to be butch, and I have accepted my innate unmanliness without complaint. Besides, it seems to me that cowards very seldom cause trouble, which is probably why there's a history of them being shot by people who do. None of this, incidentally, is to say that my infant wussiness was in any way admirable. But while I was undeniably a gutless little weed, there was an upside. At least I didn't display the habitual mindless aggression of some young males. Better a wuss than a psycho, I say, and I'm proud to say that I've never been able to force myself to watch cage fighting. If part of my weedy outlook on life came from my father's pampering, a fair proportion was down to my complicated relationship with my mother. And in this context, another early memory comes to mind. I am lying in bed, falling asleep, when a noise causes me to turn and see shadows moving on the half-open door of my bedroom. They are shadows of my parents fighting. Dad has been coming into my room, and Mum has started attacking him, pummeling him with a flurry of blows which he is trying to fend off. There's no sound. I sense they are both trying not to wake me. And the memory has no emotion attached, although it is very clear. Just the shadows, which last a few seconds, and then silence. As I read this, my throat tightens a little. The level of violence I'm describing is low. There are no shillelaghs or chainsaws here, just lower middle-class fisticuffs, with no prospect of grievous bodily harm, as English law calls it. Nevertheless, my beloved dad, a kind and decent person, is being attacked by this unknowable creature who is widely rumoured to be my mother. Young children have so little life experience that they inevitably assume that what happens around them and to them is the norm. I remember that when my daughter Cynthia was very young, she was surprised to discover that some of her friends' fathers did not work in television. So it would have been hard for me to describe my relationship with my mother as problematic because I had no idea what the word motherly conveyed to most people. Dad once described to me how during the First World War he had witnessed a wounded soldier lying in a trench and crying out for his mother. Why on earth would he cry for her, I wondered. When over the years I began to hear friends tell me that their mother was their best friend, someone with whom they routinely discussed their daily life and to whom they looked for emotional support, I simply thought, how wonderful that must be. Please do not think that I am loftily labelling her a bad mother. In many ways, she was a good mother, sometimes a very good mother. In all day-to-day matters, she was extremely diligent, preparing good meals, making sure I was properly clothed and shod and warm and dry, keeping the house neat and clean and fiercely protective of me. Under light hypnosis, I once recalled a German air raid with the sound of the bombers not far away, and Mother throwing herself on top of me under a big kitchen table. If it was a false memory, it's still what she would have done. From a practical point of view, then, she was impeccable. But she was also astonishingly anxious and self-obsessed, and that could make life with her very uncomfortable indeed. A clue to her self-obsession, I always felt, was her extraordinary lack of curiosity and therefore of general knowledge. On one of her visits to London in the late 80s, a salad was prepared for lunch which contained quail's eggs. She asked what kind of eggs they were, and I explained that they were mole's eggs, and that when we wanted them, we would go up to Hampstead Heath very early in the morning, as the moles laid them at the entrance to their burrows during the night. We'd collect the eggs and make sure that we ate them the same day before they had time to hatch. She listened with great attention, as my family's jaws sagged, and said she thought them delicious. Later that day, she caught a mention of Mary, Queen of Scots. She recognised the name and asked me who this was. With my family listening, I pushed the envelope a little, telling her that Mary was a champion Glaswegian darts player who had been killed in the Blitz. "What a shame," she said. I was being a bit naughty, of course, but I also wanted to prove to my family the truth of a comment that I'd made earlier about Mother, which they had not accepted on first hearing. I told them that she had no information about anything that was not going to affect her life directly in the immediate future, and that consequently she possessed no general knowledge. And when I said no general knowledge, I didn't mean very, very little. Naturally, they thought I'd been exaggerating. And the reason for this was not that she was unintelligent, but that she lived her life in such a constant state of high anxiety, bordering on incipient panic, that she could focus only on the things that might directly affect her. So it goes without saying that she suffered from all the usual phobias, along with a few special ones like albinos and people wearing eye patches. But she also cast her net wider. In fact, I used to joke that she suffered from omniphobia. You name it, she had a morbid dread of it. It's true that I never saw her alarmed by a loaf of bread or a cardigan or even a chair, but anything above medium size that could move around a bit was a hazard, and any reasonably loud sound startled her beyond reason. I once compiled a list of events that frightened her, and it was quite comprehensive. Very loud snoring, low-flying aircraft, church bells, fire engines, trains, buses, lorries, thunder, shouting, large cars, most medium-sized cars, noisy small cars, burglar alarms, fireworks, especially crackers, loud radios, barking dogs, whinnying horses, nearby silent horses, cows in general, megaphones, sheep, corks coming out of sparkling wine bottles, motorcycles, even very small ones, balloons being popped, vacuum cleaners not being used by her, things being dropped, dinner gongs, parrot houses, whoopee cushions, chiming doorbells, hammering, bombs, hooters, old-fashioned alarm clocks, pneumatic drills, and hairdryers, even those used by her. In a nutshell, Mother experienced the cosmos as a vast, limitless booby trap. Consequently, it was never possible for her to relax, except perhaps the times as she sat on the sofa knitting while Dad and I watched television. But even then, she was active, knitting away against time. I noticed years ago that when people, myself definitely included, are anxious, they tend to busy themselves with irrelevant activities because these distract from and therefore reduce their actual physical experience of anxiety. To stay perfectly still is to feel the fear at its maximum intensity. So instead you scuttle around doing things as though you are in some mysterious way short of time. But although Mother kept herself busy in countless and pointless ways, it did not alleviate her worrying. Her pervading sense that she was keeping nameless disasters at bay only by incessantly anticipating them, and that one moment's lapse in this vigilance would bring them hurtling towards her. I once proposed to Dad that we should purchase a large hamster wheel for her, so that she would find it easy to remain active all day instead of having continually to invent non-essential activities like polishing cans of peas, or stacking cups, or sewing borders on handkerchiefs, or boiling knitting needles, or weeding the carpet. Her own approach was to write her worries down on a piece of paper, so there was no chance that she would forget one of them. After Dad died, I would drive down to Weston to visit her, and she would greet me with a cup of coffee and a very long list of worries which she'd been compiling during the previous weeks. And we would sit down and discuss each worry in turn at some length. What it was about, why it mattered, how likely it was to happen, what she could do to forestall it, and what we could do if it did actually happen, and whether we would know what to do if it didn't. And after we'd processed six or so, she'd make me another cup of coffee, and we would continue working into the night. And if we hadn't got through them all by bedtime, we'd leave the rest for breakfast. It took me decades to realize it was not the analyzing of her worries that eased them. It was the continuous contact with another person that gradually calmed her. Why Mother should have been so anxious, I simply don't know, but the net effect was to make her difficult. Actually, difficult is not quite fair. There was only one thing that she wanted, just one. But that one thing was her own way. And if she didn't get it, that upset her. And she was pretty easily upset. In fact, I think it's fair to say she had a real facility for it. And when something did upset her, and there was a very limited supply of things that in the final analysis didn't, she would throw a tantrum, or several tantra, of such inconceivable volume and activity that there must have been times when Dad yearned for the relative tranquillity of the trenches in France. But Mother would never have seen herself as a tyrant. Her trick was to rule through weakness. Whereas Dad might prefer to sleep with the window open, Mother had to have it shut because she just couldn't cope with the alternative. Sadly, there was no choice. No negotiation was never an option, although Dad once confided to me that she'd been much more flexible before they got married. It was only in later years that I began to see just how alarmed Dad really was by the tantrums. When he talked occasionally about the need to keep the little woman on an even keel, his faux-amused casualness was intended to conceal his fear, because when Mother lost her temper, she really lost it. Her rage filled her skin until there was no room left for the rest of her personality, which had to move over till things calmed down a bit. The phrase, beside oneself with anger, could have been coined in Weston-super-Mare. Mother could be quite charming and bright and amusing. That was when we had visitors. Once they had gone, her sociability began to fade, and this meant there was nearly always tension in the Cleese household, because when Mother was not actually angry, it was because she was not angry yet. Dad and I knew that the slightest thing, almost anything, could set her off, so constant placatory behaviour was the name of the game. It cannot be a coincidence that I spent such a large part of my life in some form of therapy, and that the vast majority of the problems I was dealing with involved relationships with women. And my ingrained habit of walking on eggshells when coping with my mother dominated my romantic liaisons for many years. Until it began to fade, women found me very dull. My own unique cocktail of overpoliteness, unending solicitude, and the fear of stirring controversy rendered me utterly unsexy. Very, very, very nice men are no fun. I once wrote a sketch based on my younger self for the 1968 show How to Irritate People, in which I tried to show just how infuriating this desire to be inoffensive can be. Me, I'm afraid I'm not very good company tonight. Girlfriend. No, it's me. I'm on edge. Me. No, you're marvellous. Really, super. It's me. Girlfriend. Look, let's forget it. Me. I'm not good company. Girlfriend. You are. Me. I'm not. I've been fussing you. Girlfriend. It's all right. Me. I have been fussing you. It's my own fault. You told me last time about fussing you too much. Girlfriend. Please. Me. Look, am I fussing you too much? Girlfriend. A bit. Although there was little real emotional communication between us, my mother and I had our moments of closeness, almost all of them when we laughed together. She had quite a sharp sense of humour, and as I got older I discovered to my surprise that she also laughed at jokes that were rather dark, if not quite black. I remember on one occasion listening to her as she methodically itemised all the reasons why she didn't want to go on living, while I experienced my usual sense of glum failure at my powerlessness to help, and then I heard myself say, "Mother, I have an idea."
"Oh? Well, what is that?"
"Well, I know a little man who lives in Fulham, and if you're still feeling this way next week, I could have a word with him if you like, but only if you like, and he could come down to the retirement home and kill you." Silence. "Oh, God, I have gone too far," I thought, and then she cackled with laughter. I don't think I ever loved her as much as I did at that moment. So anyway, there we were in the Raffles house, pretty safe from German bombs, with a ringside view of a Somerset farmer's life, milking cows and fattening pigs and executing chickens. It was a very small farm, and the only surprising thing was that Mr. and Mrs. Raffle didn't speak English. I don't mean that they spoke another language. They didn't speak anything that could be recognised as a language. They clearly understood each other's noises, though, and we sensed that while they didn't like each other much, their limited vocabularies precluded unnecessary disagreements. Now, how Dad negotiated our rent with Mr. Raffle, I don't know. He probably used pebbles. Although it's possible that the Raffles' young son, who was picking up some English at kindergarten, acted as interpreter. Mr. Raffle owned two sheepdogs, so it was a bit of a surprise when we discovered that he had no sheep. Dad thought he kept the dogs so that people would think he owned sheep. Mother thought they might be cow dogs. I liked them. They were friendlier than the rabbits, although they did spend quite a lot of time staring into the rabbit hutches. As for the rabbits, I've never worked out why the Raffles actually bothered to keep any, since they had ferrets to catch them in the wild. I can only assume that having caught them, they liked to keep them fresh and close by until a quick snack beckoned. That could explain why my attacker sank its fangs into me. It was not going to go quietly. Sadly, just as I was beginning to name all the animals and to get to know the little village of Brent Knoll, the Cleese family moved to Devon to a little cottage in Totnes. There, for no apparent reason, we moved back to the Raffles, then back to Devon, to Horrobridge, where I saw a spider so big I could hear its footsteps, then back to Brent Knoll, and then immediately after VE Day to Burnham-on-Sea, where we lived in three different houses in 3 years, before arriving in Weston-super-Mare again in 1948 so that I could attend St. Peter's Preparatory School. In all, we moved 8 times in my first 8 years. I was too young to be part of a discussion on the subject, so I could only guess why we move so often. From a practical point of view, constant relocation caused few problems because it never involved Dad having to change jobs. As an agent or salesman with the Guardian Assurance Company, he had been assigned a territory in the West Country which he drove around selling mainly life insurance but also a lot of storm and tempest cover to farmers. Because he was known to be such a decent chap, a lot of the life insurance came to him via personal recommendations from Somerset bank managers and solicitors. They knew he was competent and honest and would not try to sell their clients more cover than they needed. This meant he always sold more life assurance than any of the other Guardian agents, but in a rather leisurely way, never driving off before about 9:30 in the morning, nor returning after 4:30 in the afternoon. His secret was that because of his contacts, he never needed to make cold calls. And provided he lived in the southwest of England, it didn't much matter where, as the distances were so small. If the demands of Dad's job don't explain the constant moves, his worries about money might. As an insurance agent, his earnings peaked at £30 a week in the early 50s. Given that miners and most footballers got £10 a week, it was not a bad salary, and I certainly never sensed that we lacked for anything. Moreover, the Cleese family never contemplated buying. expensive things. They weren't on our radar. For example, it literally never occurred to me that we might go abroad for our holidays, or we might buy a car that was new, or that we would have anything for our Christmas lunch other than chicken. Nevertheless, such outlandish thoughts must have occurred to my father, who was kind and generous and would have loved to have provided us with a more gracious lifestyle of the kind he'd enjoyed while working in India, Hong Kong, and China in the early 20s. £1,500 per annum, however, didn't stretch very far, and although he hid his financial anxieties very well, I did begin to notice that now and again he'd go out his way to save money on a purchase. Mother noticed, too, and we would look at each other as he extolled surprisingly inexpensive, stylish Yugoslavian sports jackets, or top-class Libyan shoes, or premier-quality Albanian ham that he'd bought, knowing full well that they would soon lose shape or prove unwearable or taste very odd indeed. It's not unreasonable to assume, therefore, that most of our moves were motivated by the hallucination that they would help cut costs. But they may also have had an unintended side effect. Research has shown that constant relocation in childhood is often associated with creativity. It seems that the creative impulse is sparked by the need to reconcile contrasting views of the world. If you move home, you start living a slightly different life, so you compare it with your previous life. You note the divergences and the similarities. You see what you like better and what you miss. And as you do, your mind becomes more flexible and capable of combining thoughts and ideas in new and fresh ways. And there's also another way that creativity can develop. If important people in your life, especially parents, have different ways of viewing the world, and you find yourself trying to understand what they have in common and how they contrast in an attempt to make sense of their conflicting views. On the other hand, if your parents have a harmonious relationship and you grow up in one place where people share the same attitudes as those around you, you're unlikely to be innovative or even to want to be. I doubt whether there's a special creative faculty at Iowa State University. So, creatively, I was doubly blessed. Constant relocation and parental disharmony. Add to these two gifts the well-established fact that many of the world's greatest geniuses, both artistic and scientific, have been the product of serious maternal deprivation, and I am forced to the conclusion that if only my mother had been just a little more emotionally inadequate, I could have been huge. I could have been musically gifted and talented in the visual arts, an outstanding dancer and inventor and a published poet, instead of being good within very limited parameters at writing and acting comedy. Oh, well. Despite these early years spent charging around the West Country, I have only a few scattered memories other than the Raffles Farm and the Horrorbridge Spider. I remember, for example, being out for a walk with Dad and hearing a rumbling sound and looking up and seeing the sky fill with large planes, apparently flying towards the Germans. This was one of our daytime raids, Dad explained. We were winning the war, so we didn't have to fly at night anymore. Once, Dad and I talked to a nice young American airman who let me get up into his Jeep where I scraped my precious ankle. On another occasion, Dad drove us to the hills behind Weston, where we looked at a German plane that had crashed in a field. It was smaller than I'd expected, and there were lots of sightseers, but they were all very quiet. Best of all were the Sundays, when Dad would take me to Brent Knoll railway station. Here we were allowed up into the signal box, and the signalman would let me move the big levers that changed the points. Then we would go down onto the platform, where there would be a huge wickerwork hamper full of racing pigeons, and the station master would let me open the lid wide, and the pigeons would fly up and away in a tightly knit flock, high into the sky, where they would circle round and round three times, always three times, before heading north to their homes in Widnes and Warrington and Wigan. It was the most exciting and beautiful experience. The only direct effect that the war had on our lives came when my parents received news that our furniture had been destroyed. The day we first moved into the Raffles, my parents had moved their furniture into a storage in a warehouse owned by Lalonde's, the well-known Westonian auctioneers, and now an incendiary bomb had overcooked it. It wasn't very posh furniture, of course, and in a way, The Bosch did us a favour, because now we could move from house to house with much greater ease, passing between various kinds of furnished accommodation, unencumbered by very much in the way of belongings. I noticed that a lot of my early memories are connected with the war, but this is simply because such moments stood out so starkly from my normal, everyday experience. Months passed in the Somerset and Devon countryside without my being even vaguely aware of the conflict. In fact, I now realise how glad I am that I grew up in small West Country villages surrounded by verdant foliage and emerald hues. I associate all this with a kind of quiet contentment of effortless, calm mindfulness that I can seldom recapture in cities. Reading years ago what the psychologist Abraham Maslow had to say about peak experiences, I recognize that these moments nearly always occur in repose, and in my case, are never connected with work. Wordsworth wrote of his favorite flowers, "For oft, when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude, and then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the chrysanthemums." When I recall moments of perfect, timeless happiness, they include sitting in a deck chair in the garden of my house in Holland Park, staring at two Burmese kittens doing cabaret, looking at Vermeer's painting of Delft and allowing it to affect me, playing with a baby kangaroo in a Sydney hotel room, listening to John Williams playing the guitar, cruising down the Middle Rhine sipping Moselle, eating fish and chips with my wife at Gilles 2 nights ago, or lying in the grass in the sun and having my inward eye conjure up images of Dick Cheney being waterboarded. Again, none of them seem to be connected with work or indeed any kind of striving. Explain that to Terry Gilliam.